Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Coming to Gardner Spring Auditorium in Ontario, April 2nd, an all-star six-act concert featuring Leon Hughes Coasters, Sonny Turner's Platters, Little Peggy, Barbara Lewis, Pat Boone, and tonight's guest, Johnny Tillotson. He had a bunch of hits starting in 1959 and nearing the top of the charts in the early to mid-60s. He also gave us the theme song for Gidget and was in one of the worst movies ever made. We'll have music and conversation with Johnny Tillotson later in the program. We're going to start tonight with Emmanuel Rogers, checking out something very cerebral and perhaps some simple ways to slow down just a bit.
Joining us today is author and medical doctor Joseph A. Annibale. Dr. Annibale shares info from his new book, Reclaim Your Brain. Thank you for joining us today, doctor.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, we're more than glad to have you. Anybody that can help slow down our thoughts and our little minds here is welcome to this show, trust me.
Well, I'm happy to try.
All right. Dr. Annibale, you are chief psychiatrist for the world-renowned Amen Clinics in Reston, Virginia. Your book, Reclaim Right. Your Brain, introduced me to a new term, busy brain. What is that?
Well, lots of people have a busy brain, and I like to say that I've got some skin in the game because I feel like I've had a busy brain.
Okay.
And I also talk in the book about negativity, which is connected to a busy brain. But a busy brain is the subjective sense, the experience, the feeling of too much going on in the brain. Some people feel like they've got two or three radios playing different stations in their head, or they've got a buzzing beehive. So it's a sense of too much brain activity. Often people feel stressed and distracted. And the busy world we live in doesn't help and, of course, contributes to this feeling stressed. But my book is primarily not about turn off your cell phone, turn off the TV, et cetera. It's more about how our brains work, the relationship of the prefrontal cortex to the limbic system, and how, when readers understand how the brain works, what are the simple but effective steps they can take to calm a busy brain.
Now, in your book, you also discuss there are different things that can cause busy brain, including brain injuries.
That's right. A brain injury is much more common than many people realize, including many physicians. We like to talk about the prefrontal cortex, which is the CEO of the brain, the manager of the brain, and then the limbic system, which is the deeper, more primitive emotional areas. So in a well-functioning, balanced brain, the prefrontal cortex is able to appropriately rein in what I call the wild horses of the limbic system of the emotional centers. If you have damage to the prefrontal cortex, if you're in a car accident, or you're a senior on the basketball team in high school, and you get knocked over and smack your head on the hardwood floor, you can have brain injury. And if you have brain injury in the front of the brain there, you're not able appropriately to rein in your impulses, so you may be more moody or irritable, make poor choices. And because of the imbalance, then you're also much more likely to have a busy brain as well.
What I'd like to ask you is, children, do they start off with busy brains, or is this learned for them?
Well, you know, that's a good question. Children's brains, when we do brain imaging, and at Amen Clinics we do a special kind of brain scanning called brain SPECT imaging, which looks at brain function. So we typically find that the younger somebody is, the more active brain they have. And in fact, it was a child who got me started down the path of thinking about a busy brain. It was an eight-year-old boy with what we call a ring of fire pattern. Basically, his whole cerebral cortex was way overactive. And I had been in the habit of asking him what it was like because I wanted to try to understand what the experience was like. And he was the one who said, you know, it's like I have two or three radios in my head.
Right.
And kind of for me, a light bulb went off. So younger people tend to have much more active brains because they haven't yet pruned unnecessary connections, nerve cell connections. So as we get older, brain activity declines, but at the same time, it becomes more efficient. So short answer, younger brains tend to be more active, and kids do tend to have a busy brain. Yes.
Now, is there a way that as parents and caretakers that we can teach them how to slow their minds down before it gets to the point where, you know, they are just so confused and frustrated by too many thoughts running around?
the way you can do it is to be, in a way, an external brain for them because they don't have a fully developed prefrontal cortex. You need to think about what's going on in their lives. And, for example, you know, you probably, if you have a young daughter of 5 or 6, you probably don't want her to watch a really scary horror movie.
Right.
Because, you know, she's going to have nightmares. Now, she may say, you know, my friend's going, and I really want to see it, and I think it'll be okay. But you think for her that's going to be too stimulating. Or maybe for your son, your young son, you know that when he eats a candy bar, he starts to vibrate like a tuning fork because the sugar gives him too much stimulation. So,
right.
So we think about what's going to be stimulating for them, including what would increase brain stimulation, and then we think about it and try to help them settle down if they're already too aroused. And I think we do this naturally, you know. I think, you know, Mother Nature has built this into parents, and, you know, a parent with a reasonably functioning brain, him or herself, will do this naturally.
This is Emmanuel Rogers speaking with Joseph A. Annibale, medical doctor, as he shares ways to train your brain to think more positively and eliminate runaway negative thoughts for a healthier thought life. Now, Doctor, also, you brought up earlier the fact of negative thoughts. Why do we
right.
have so many negative thoughts in the first place?
It's very interesting. I say that the default position of the human psyche is negative. And by that I mean that, you know, at its core, so to speak, the brain wants to be negative. This comes about for several reasons. One reason is that the right side of the brain, the right hemisphere of the brain, develops earlier than the left in infancy and early childhood. And the right hemisphere tends to be negative. So the young child has that, they filter, you know, the experiences through the right hemisphere, which tends to be negative. And the memory system they have, again, when they're young, it's not the hippocampus that we use as adults, which has nice, robust, and plastic declarative memory. They have the amygdala, which is rather crude and is the, you know, primarily negative and kind of scary. So that's the brain environment they have, and their experiences are filtered through the right hemisphere and the amygdala. And then from another point of view, if you think about, okay, well, why is that? You know, if you think about an evolutionary point of view, our so-called primitive ancestors living on the savanna or in the jungle somewhere, for them to survive in that environment, those individuals who were nervous and anxious and worried and had a lot of negative thoughts about what if this, what if that, what if that, you know, what's behind that rock? I hear rustling in the bushes. Is that a lion? And I thought I saw somebody behind that hill. You know, is that an adversary? So people, our primitive ancestors, people who thought like that probably are going to survive more.
Huh.
So Mother Nature favors behaviors and the structure of the nervous system that promotes survival. Mother Nature doesn't care so much whether we're happy. So we still have these genetic patterns that are kind of built into us, but we're not living on the savannah. We're not living in the jungle anymore, you know. I think sometimes we feel that we are. If you're in L.A., you've got some traffic. I've got traffic here in D.C. You know, I wonder if we're so far from the jungle, frankly, the way people behave sometimes. But by and large, we are. And yet we still have these mechanisms that generate so much negativity for ourselves and for others, and we need to learn to combat them.
You spoke a little bit about brain injuries.
Mm-hmm.
My question for you is also about brain injuries, but traumatic events and Lyme disease. How do they affect the thought processes? Because you do a lot of work with helping people recovering from Lyme disease.
Right. So by traumatic events, do you mean emotionally traumatic?
Emotionally traumatic, physically traumatic. They don't have to be brain injuries.
Yeah. So somebody with emotional traumas, I say that the trauma is branded in their brain. And there's a particular pattern we see when we do brain scans, a particular pattern we see in their limbic system and the emotional centers of the brain. We call it a diamond pattern. And it's a significant amount of overactivity. It actually makes a diamond if you look closely.
Wow.
But people who are traumatized in that way, it's as if the past is always alive in the present. They're always on guard. They're always waiting for the other shoe to drop. Their sentinel systems are on high alert. So they have a tremendously busy brain because they're always on alert. They're always over aroused. Lyme disease, and certainly, you know, it's interesting. I've seen people with Lyme disease who've actually had PTSD resulting from it. My own daughter has Lyme disease, so I've learned a lot about it through her. And I've seen hundreds of patients with Lyme and helped them. So I've learned so much about it over the years. But Lyme treatment can be very difficult, and Lyme can be a very serious, even life-threatening condition. So generally, Lyme causes a toxic scalloped appearance when we do a particular kind of, you know, the brain imaging we do. It also can increase limbic system activity because of the inflammation related to the Lyme infections. Lyme loves the brain. The Lyme organisms, Borrelia, love to burrow into nerve cells, and typically people with Lyme will have brain fog, memory problems, they can't focus, they can't concentrate, they have trouble with words, with language. So it's a real problem. It's a real problem, and it's an absolute epidemic up and down the East Coast into the Midwest, and I know certainly you have it in California as well.
Yes, yes.
People used to think you wouldn't because of the climate you have, but you do. So it's really something. It's really something, and it's not going to go away. I think it's just going to get worse and worse.
Now, as our time is coming to an end, I do have two questions I hope that you can kind of put together for me. One involves mindfulness, and what is the importance of mindfulness? And the other is, what are the steps that we should take to calm our thoughts and heal our minds and bring our life back under control?
Well.
Yeah.
Well, I wish we had a little more time,
I
but
do too.
I'll try to address those. So mindfulness, in a way, it's thinking about thinking, becoming more aware of your thought patterns. So it's a way of stepping back and looking at your thoughts. And in doing so, we become more present. So if I sort of sprint down the hallway in my clinic, that's not very mindful.
No.
And I have some tendency to do that when I feel rushed. But if I take my time and notice the contact of the soles of my shoes with the carpet in the hall, I'm existing in the moment. I'm living in the moment rather than projecting myself into the future. Oh, I've got these three things to do, and what about this? What about that? So
wow.
It helps calm down a busy brain. So I would encourage everybody to have some kind of mindfulness approach. And then how do we deal with a busy brain, a negative brain? We need to realize that our thoughts aren't true. Thoughts are often negative, but thoughts aren't true. We just have these thoughts automatically. That's what the brain does. So we need to remind ourselves that thoughts aren't true. And also, then we need to write down our negative thoughts, you know, write down a pad of paper.
Yeah.
And then we ask ourselves some simple questions, and I do talk about these in the book at quite some length, but, you know, is this negative thought true? Can I know absolutely it's true? What's the impact on me of having this negative thought? Where would I be without this thought? So each of these questions is a kind of mini meditation. It's not just rushing through.
Ah.
But in doing so, we find that these negative thoughts let go of us, or maybe we let go of them, depending on how you see it. And we can be more at peace, our brains can be more at peace, we can be more in the moment. And that's what we're all looking for. We
right.
want to feel at peace, we want to be at peace, we want to generate peace in the world. You know, be
yes.
the peace you'd like to see in the world. Not a bad position.
It's a very simple concept. I like it.
Yeah.
Now, before I let
Not
you...
Not always easy to do, though.
No.
But it is simple, you're right.
Now, before I let you go, Doctor, where can our listeners go to find out more about your work and this wonderful book, Reclaim Your Brain?
People can get information on the book at Amazon, of course. They could also purchase the book at AimonClinics.com and the Brain Store. And there's a lot of
wow.
information on the Amon Clinics website about me. I'm located in the Washington, D.C. clinic. They can also go to www.brainmdhealth.com. And I know there are a number of talks and presentations I've done over the years that people have videotaped. I would bet if you go to YouTube, there's some of those things of me there, too. So if they look around a little bit, they'll find out a lot about me.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Anibali. I have a copy of your book, but I have to repurchase another one because no sooner had I finished going through it, I met someone who was talking about that very subject, and they needed your book. So it's theirs, and I'll get another copy.
That's wonderful to hear. That's wonderful to hear. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us and sharing.
Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Dr. Joseph Anibali, author of Reclaim Your Brain. More information at Amazon and other online retailers, amenclinics.com, also brainmdhealth.com. As KVC Arts continues, it's music and conversation with Johnny Tillotson, part of an all-star lineup coming to Ontario soon with a celebration of the music of the 1950s and 60s.
KVCR has tickets for Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. For a one-day tour stop at Fox Performing Arts Center with two shows on Sunday, April 10th. Tickets online at kvcrnews.org/events.
One more angel in heaven.
This week, Says You hails from Vermont with some syrupy sentimentality. Over the years, Ben & Jerry has also introduced scores of flavors, some of which succeeded, some melted away.
Festivus.
Festivus.
As a flavor.
Alexander Graham Cracker. Or Oatmeal Cookie Crunch.
Alexander Graham Cracker.
No.
Really?
That's Says You.
Saturday at 1 p.m. and Sunday evening at 7.
Dream.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming to Gardner Spring Auditorium in Ontario, April 2nd, an all-star six-act concert featuring Leon Hughes Coasters, Sonny Turner's Platters, Little Peggy, Barbara Lewis, Pat Boone, and tonight's guest, Johnny Tillotson.
When I take you home, I feel so awful.
Early on, between moving back and forth from your home in Jacksonville to over where your grandma was living, you ended up on some TV shows. And didn't you even have your own TV show early on at WFGA?
Yeah, I had my own television show, and that was in Jacksonville. And we didn't have the big buses and things they have today, so we would drive up sometime from University of Florida to Jacksonville, where we did our television show.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. And now, looking at the timeline on this, I understand WFGA was the first television station in the United States that was designed for color broadcasting. So was your show in color?
I think we were in color.
And you had to have realized, yeah, that was a brand new thing for so many people. Also early on, you got noticed for singing in the Pet Milk Contest. Was there a theme song for Pet Milk, or was it just a contest that they were putting on?
No, Pet Milk, along with WSM, sponsored a Pet Milk Talent Contest. And a local disc jockey found a tape of mine and sent it into Pet Milk, and all of a sudden we were in the contest, and we were one of the, I think, six national winners. So, of course, I had a chance to go to Nashville, and I took my tape along with me of original songs. And at the show that night, a lady named Lee Rosenberg came up to me, and she said, "The crowd really loved you, and I was just wondering, do you write songs?" I said, "Well, I do." And she said, "Well, you know, Archie Blyer is in town. He records the Everly Brothers. Would you like me to get the tape to Archie so he could, if it's something he might like to record?" And so that's how that started, and we got it to Archie, and Archie called back in a few days, and he said, "My daughter really likes that song, and she says you sound like half of an Everly Brother." So that's how that started.
Within your dream, we are.
You mentioned this getting you to Nashville, but I don't believe you mentioned that this got you to the Grand Ole Opry.
Rocking queen with eyes.
How old were you at this point performing at the Opry?
Well, this was just a special opportunity to perform at the Grand Ole Opry. And I used to go over there with Johnny Russell. And I thought, too, that what a great honor to be on the Grand Ole Opry. I used to listen to it on Saturday nights. I always loved country music, and I loved the Grand Ole Opry.
Okay.
You're the girl I want to hug. And I'm the boy who thinks you're grand. Don't believe me, girl. Whipple, I'm your man.
One of the things that I just really took to note, with your TV experience and even performing at the Grand Ole Opry and all that, all of these things were before you finished your bachelor's degree, and maybe I should put it this way, that despite relative success in music at this point, you still kept going back to finish your bachelor's. Did you
have... Well, I had promised my parents that I would finish school and get my diploma from the University of Florida, and I didn't want to let them down. And so that's exactly correct. I felt I could give 100% if I had done this already. So I got a bachelor's degree in journalism and communication, which helped me a lot in my work.
After you finished your degree, you did go off to New York with the intention of music, not so much journalism, your degree. So was it at this point looking for labels, or just really like an actor or any singer or whatever, looking for any job and then recording singles as you may? How did that experience work for you then?
Well, I had met Archie Blyer when he was in Nashville, and I told him that I wanted to record, and he said, well, why don't you come to New York? I said, well, I don't have any money to come to New York. I said, I mean, I really don't have any money. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll send you a ticket, and you can fly up to New York. My wife and I and daughter will pick you up at the airport. You can just stay with us. And what we'll do is we will try to find hit songs. And trust me, we won't squander your money. We won't go in a studio unless we have something that we think is a hit. And also, I'll look forward to you doing some writing for me. With the love of you, man. Everything just worked perfectly. I've written Dreamy Eyes and Well, I'm Your Man, which is kind of like a Buddy Holly thing. So that's kind of how I got in with Archie, and I was perfectly happy. I stayed out at the house with Archie and Janet right up until Poetry in Motion, and I think I probably overstayed my welcome. But all we did is look for hit songs. He said, you know, we can record all the time, but you really want to just record when you have something that you think is going to be a hit. It'll be better for your career and better for everything. Oh, my darling,
why do I love you so? We're speaking with Johnny Tillotson. He'll be performing in Ontario soon along with Leon Hughes' Coasters, Sonny Turner's Platters, Little Peggy, Pat Boone, and Barbara Lewis. That's April 2nd at Gardner Spring Auditorium. More information at affordablemusicproductions.com. Starting around 1959 in releases in 59 and 60, a succession of singles, True True, Happiness, Why Do I Love You So, and one in particular that I want to ask about, a double-sided single, Earth Angel and Pledging My Love. With Earth Angel, this was given to us by the Penguins in 54 and then the Crew Cuts the next year. You did this around 1960, so I'm curious if this song was still popular on the radio, or by the time you did it, was it looked at as a resurgence?
Archie always liked the song. He thought if he could put Pledging My Love on one side and Earth Angel on the other side, that would be a good way to come out with a product especially aimed at that market. Kind of like a doo-wop sound, you know what I mean?
Oh, certainly. You had a lot of sweet music, a lot of beautiful melodies. So was this actually an attempt at a crossover to the R&B genre?
He just always liked Earth Angel and Poetry in Motion, and he had such a good record of picking songs that turned out to be hits. I could see where that might be a good thing. And in our concerts, we always do Earth Angel, as a matter of fact. I'm just a fool. With you. The audience seems to like my version quite a lot.
Well, that's a tune that you can't go wrong with.
Can't miss, certainly. That's right.
And one would hope that we'd be seeing that in Ontario real soon.
We'll be doing that.
Oh, good.
We're looking forward to that show so much.
It's going to be so exciting. You're going to be there along with Sonny Turner with the Platters and Leon Hughes coasters and Pat Boone.
We don't leave out my buddy Pat Boone.
Certainly not.
Those are special memories for sure.
I think that's one reason
that the music stands the test of time. All these songs bring back such wonderful memories of people when they're just first starting out in life, and they're first dating, and all of those great magic things that happen to you. The music just kind of reinforces that.
Love you all the time. I'm just a fool. A fool in love with you. When I see my baby, what do I see? Poetry in motion.
Before we move on, we were talking about these various singles. Were singles more of a focus than albums in the late 50s, early 60s?
Yes, they were. The albums really started to sell around in the early 60s, like 1961, 62. But before then, it was mostly singles. You're absolutely right.
So there probably wasn't a lot of thought put into, well, this song would follow this one and make an entire flow of an album. They were just truly a collection of singles that would fill up 44 and a half minutes.
Right. But then when the Keeps Right on a Hurtin' came along with Ray Charles' Modern Sounds of Country Western Music, the album It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'
has
all kinds of wonderful country songs and country pop songs that make it very special. So they started in about 62 to do that. That was a very big break for me because people loved It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'.
A lot of the singles that we were just speaking of, they all reached, say, the bottom half of the top 100 or so, but then you came in with Poetry in Motion. This was written by Paul Kaufman and Mike Anthony. Were Kaufman and Anthony writers for the label, or did they find you somehow? How did this one work, getting Poetry in Motion?
They were writers, and they co-wrote on the song, and they wrote every day in a little writing studio, and the way the song came about, they had tried all day to come up with something that was clever and something that was good, and they just hadn't hit upon it that day. So finally, they decided, well, why don't we just not worry about it and take a break? And they got a Coke, and they walked over to the window, and they started looking at these girls walking home from school. And Mike or Paul said to the other one, you know, that's Poetry in Motion. And they said, well, why don't we write something that's complimentary to girls and the way they move and the way they smile and call it Poetry in Motion. And it was a good idea because people all over the world could relate to somebody who was Poetry in Motion.
Oh, wow. I guarantee you, after we hang up, I'm going to be going back and re-listening to the lyrics to look at it that way. That's incredible.
Oh, it's a very complimentary way. And when we do it in our shows, quite often I'll just dedicate it to all the ladies in the audience because it was written about them, you know?
Beautiful. And every single one of them is receiving it sent to them. That's really cool.
That's right. Well, it was done intentionally. Absolutely.
This was recorded in Nashville with folks including Boots Randolph and Floyd Kramer. And now when I think of Floyd Kramer and Boots Randolph, I mainly think of them alongside Chet Atkins. So when you recorded Poetry in Motion, were Kramer and Randolph at this point simply contracted session musicians, or were they already the go-to Atkins, Floyd, and Boots power trio that they became?
When we recorded in Nashville, we always requested Lightning Chance and Bob Moore on bass and Buddy Emmons on drums, Hank Garland sometimes. They called them the A-Team, and we always were lucky to get the A-Team. And on Poetry in Motion, I had recorded it first up in New York, and it was good, but it wasn't quite in the groove. So Archie said, well, do you want to go down to Nashville and do it there? And I said, yeah, and we could even do the horn part. So we flew Boots in from Evansville, Indiana, and he played on that part. And he did a great job, too.
Exciting to see his name along with Floyd Kramer.
Anytime you walked in with the A-team, you always thought your chances were bigger and better, that you really had something magical.
And it keeps right on a hurting since you're gone.
This song has been referenced a couple of times now since we've been speaking, but it was around this time we got one that you wrote, It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'. Very specifically, Johnny, the line that follows that, it keeps right on a hurtin' since you're gone. And I can see so many people taking this song as a yearning for a girl or a lost loved one in another fashion. And listening to the lyrics, I have to say this isn't a stretch at all. But would you mind please sharing what the actual inspiration for the song was?
Since you're gone.
Originally, I had wanted to write a country song for Buck Owens. So I had sent the song up to Buck Owens, and he liked the song, but he'd already recorded. So I showed it to Archie. I said, what do you think of the song? He said, well, I think we should do it with you, because he liked what I did on the demo, and he said, let's go in and put it down with you. And so we did It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'. Anita Kerr did the high part on It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'. And while we were recording it, she took a break and came over. She said, you know, Johnny, I think that's a hit song. And she was right.
Don't mind going there. Wasn't this actually written because of a terminal illness of your father?
Of my father, yeah. That's correct.
But when it was written, though,
it could be written from a standpoint of a lost girl or anybody that's suffering loss. You're right.
Absolutely. So was that intentional to try to leave it open for interpretation?
Correct.
Nice.
Exactly.
That's really nice. Now, and I find it interesting to note that I think that while you were pretty much coming up in the world of music, you were coming up in the world of Elvis, and he ended up covering this tune, It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'. So, man.
Quite a few people recorded It Keeps Right on a Hurtin', as, you know, Dean Martin, Billy Joe Royal, mm-hmm. Conway Twitty. But when Elvis recorded it, that was really special because he was my favorite singer, recording artist, and promotion person was Elvis. And I just loved the fact that he would think enough of my song to want to do it. And he put in an album that was a big album called From Elvis in Memphis, which had In the Ghetto in it and some great songs. And I'll never forget, I was with him in Las Vegas. And he said, Johnny, can I talk to you a moment? And I said, sure. And he said, you know, I on your song that I recorded, he said, you know, I changed some of the words on the second verse. I said, Elvis, it doesn't matter. You could have changed the title and I wouldn't have cared. It's true. But he was that kind of guy. If he knew that you wrote the song, he wanted to make sure that he wasn't taking advantage of you.
That's really cool, I have to say.
Yeah, it was really something, actually.
Wow.
But he just wanted to know that he changed a couple of words, and was it all right? And I said, sure was.
Nice. That's Johnny Tillotson, part of an all-star six-act concert, including Leon Hughes' Coasters, Sonny Turner's Platters, Little Peggy, Barbara Lewis, and Pat Boone. Just ahead, Johnny being placed with other teen idols of the time, and one of his next big hits, Talk Back, Tremblin' Lips. We'll also hear about some TV theme work and him being in one of the worst movies ever made with Jane Mansfield.
And it keeps right on a hurtin' since you go. Yes, it keeps right on a hurtin' since you go.
You're listening to KBC Arts on 91.9 KBCR. We are online at kbcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Back now to music and conversation with Johnny Tillotson. Work with a great TV show, a really, really bad movie, and his next big hits.
Talk back, trembling lips, shaky legs, don't just stand there. Don't let her know that she's getting through to you. Talk back, trembling lips.
I think around the time of Poetry in Motion, or maybe right after Poetry in Motion, there was kind of a point where you were featured in some of the Teen Idol magazines. And now I can see the excitement of being placed next to Elvis and Ricky Nelson and all, but also I could see where it could be sort of a, hey, it's all about the music, man. Don't make me into the Teen Idol category. So,
oh, no, I like the Teen Idol.
Yeah, okay.
We did the Clark Caravan of Stars tours on the bus, and all of us guys really kind of lived for the fact that we were lucky to have so many wonderful fans. And those fans were really important to giving us hits, you know. Today, when people come to the show, they relate, you know, wonderful times that they've had because of the music, and it means a lot to us. I like it. Sometimes they put me next to Annette Funicello, and yeah, I like that.
Talk back, trembling lips, burning eyes, don't start crying. Heart, don't let her know that you're brave.
Well, after Bits, the Cadence label folded, and you moved to MGM with, I read, your own production company. And what
That's
you came
right.
out with then was Talk Back, Trembling Lips. Now, this was a cover.
We needed a song that would show that we've made the transition to a new label, and there's nothing better than to make a transition than to come up with a hit song and a hit record. So we came out with Talk Back, Trembling Lips. And that was my first release on MGM.
Don't let her know that she's...
And it did well for you, too. I know that that
it
one
sure
got to
did.
Number seven, I believe.
You're right. I remember that myself.
Well, this was a cover of something, though, that had been number one on
Ernest
the country
Ashworth.
Chart. Yeah.
I was in Nashville, and I was listening to Ralph Emery, and they played this song by Ernest Ashworth. And I said, you know, this is a very interesting piece of music because it's got this bouncy kind of melody, but yet in reality it's kind of sad. You know, Talk Back, Shaky Leg, it was different. And so I thought that might be a really big song, and I was right on that one. So Talk Back, Trembling Lips was top seven, and that kind of launched my career with MGM.
Was there any initial concern that this was a perceived country song, looking at you in a different direction?
I think they saw a continuity, the fans saw a continuity between It Keeps Right On A-Hurtin' into I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry and so forth, into Talk Back, Trembling Lips. It had a certain continuity to it. When we went to MGM, we brought with us Talk Back, Trembling Lips. And that made the transition very smooth.
Heart, don't let her know that you're breaking in two.
Now, this is a bit of a sidebar, but there are people, let's just say they were living under a rock and not hearing any of these wonderfully popular tunes that you had going left and right. You ended up being known, whether or not people knew your name, okay? People ended up knowing your voice, perhaps weekly, with a very specific television theme song. So
well, you must be talking about Gidget?
Absolutely.
Wait till you see my Gidget. You're headed for a big surprise. The way she walks, the way she talks, you won't believe your eyes.
So, how?
Wait Till You See My Gidget was written by Jack Keller and Howard Greenfield, and we just loved doing that song. Jimmy Darren did the other version, which was the movie version, and then I did the TV version.
So how did this come about?
I had known Howard Greenfield and Neil Sedaka and Jack Keller for a long time, and I happened to be on 57th Street, and Howard waved at me. And I waved back, and he said, wait up just a minute. So I went over, and he said, listen, we're going out to the West Coast, I'm writing some themes, and we've written a song for the TV show called Gidget. It's called Wait Till You See My Gidget. Would you be interested in recording it? And I said, sure. I didn't even have to hear it. But I just love the whole idea of Wait Till You See My Gidget. You want her for your Valentine. And I said, I think ladies will really enjoy that song. And they did. They like Wait Till You See My Gidget a lot.
It's a fun tune. And I'm curious if singing a TV theme seemed like an opportunity.
That was exceptionally exciting. I hadn't done that many TV themes, but so it was a new exposure for me, and I liked it very much.
When you do this sort of thing, singing TV themes and whatnot, mind you, I'm not asking you how much money you made on that, but I do want to know, is it a case where you get paid to go into a studio and sing something, or is it more like there's a back end, there's a percentage every time Gidget airs?
Well, that's a good question.
Thank you. Or like you got your $50 and that was it.
It was kind of a career opportunity to be something that was going to turn out to be such a big record. So you would accept doing Wait Till You See My Gidget as a career move more than a financial move. So Charlie Colello, he had done a lot of the Four Seasons things.
Oh, wow.
And he said, I'll do the arrangement, that I just sang it. But I felt really good about it. I felt that we had really done a good job on Wait Till You See My Gidget. And Sally Field liked it, and everybody liked it. So money was not a big deal on that. It was just another song that I wanted to do, except this one was going to be the theme for a TV show.
Okay. There's actually one of the nice things about this one song is that it's a song that not only is a fun TV theme, but it actually is a theme that can be listened to independently just as a song in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. It's very complimentary to, Gidget, like America's Sweetheart.
Oh, yeah. Gidget is spoken for, you're gonna find that Gidget is mine. That's Johnny Tillotson coming to Ontario soon, along with Leon Hughes Coasters, Sonny Turner's Platters, Little Peggy, Barbara Lewis, and Pat Boone. More information at affordablemusicproductions.com. In addition to doing the TV themes, you ended up in a film here. And you may or may not admit to this one, but it's public knowledge at this point. You appeared in the 1966 comedy The Fat Spy, which also had Jane Mansfield.
Wasn't that voted the worst movie ever?
Yeah, that's my question, too. Well, you got to number 46 of the 50 worst movies ever made with that movie. So.
That's right.
Yeah, what was the involvement?
I was happy to get it. Here's the story behind The Fat Spy.
Please.
We heard that there was some interest in me doing a movie, and I said, well, tell me about the movie. And they said, well, Jane Mansfield is in the movie.
Gotcha.
And I said, say no more. I said, I'd love to do the movie, just have the opportunity to meet Jane Mansfield. But the sad part is, they were shooting on the lot, so I went there a few days ahead in order to say hello to Jane Mansfield. What I didn't know was the movie business, and Jane had come in the week before, and she had done all of her takes, and she was no longer there, and I was so disappointed.
Oh, no.
And I said, well, where's Jane Mansfield? She was here a week ago. And I said, well, she's not here now. She said, no, but Phyllis Diller is here. Now, that was kind of sweet, because I got to know Phyllis Diller, and we became friends all through her wonderful life. And she was the sweetest gal. So I felt we turned a kind of disappointing situation into a really a positive thing with her. And she was just the greatest. So I thought you might like to hear how it went from Jane Mansfield to Phyllis Diller.
But so nice that it became a friendship afterwards.
Oh, yeah. It was very, very nice.
That's incredible.
And none of us that did the movie expected it to get such bad reviews. We were kind of crushed, but the way it goes.
Okay, but you accepted it. You wear the badge with
Rolled
honor.
On, yeah.
Okay.
And don't be, we came close to meeting Jane Mansfield.
Well, yeah, it's closer than I ever got. You know, another movie, a Japanese movie, Namida Kun Sayonara, and you apparently...
Namida Kun Sayonara, yeah.
Thank you.
Well, that was the big hit for me in Japan. So Namida Kun Sayonara, it was a very simple thing. It was a story about an American artist going to Japan to perform. And, of course, I sang my number one hit that was number one in Japan, Namida Kun Sayonara. That was kind of a cute little movie. I don't think anybody rated that badly. But Namida Kun Sayonara was a really fun little movie to do because I was basically playing myself.
Do you know if you can still track that movie down? Is it out there anywhere?
I'm sure it is, if you just look it up on the computer.
Namida kun sayonara, sayonara namida kun, mata au himade.
Okay, back to music then, John.
Okay.
Although I started this list of questions with questions about Gidget, Jane Mansfield, and it worked around from there. But regarding music, you seemed to be recording and releasing every couple of years or so through the 60s and into the 70s. In the early 80s, you did chart with Lay Back in the Arms of Someone. And then it also seemed to be in the 80s that you seemed to be the rage of Southeast Asia and Australia and New Zealand. You seemed to stay busy with tours.
Well, that's
there.
Right. That's right. We were very fortunate that our songs were so well accepted in places like Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore. And all of these wonderful people knew the songs. So when I would go into Poetry in Motion or Cutie Pie or She Understands Me or whatever, they would know the songs. And I was curious how they would remember the songs. And they said, because when you sing so clearly. And we were able to learn the words, even though sometimes I'm not sure they knew all the words. But in fact, we're getting ready to go back to Thailand shortly. So Thailand is one of our major markets all through the year. And Malaysia, too. Those things, they were done because there was a legitimate reason for me to be there, because we were very popular. Just like today, we take engagements in Thailand and Singapore and Malaysia because we have so many fans, and we're so grateful to the people for remembering our songs and having us back time after time.
It's a treat, and that when you've had a career that spanned as much time as yours, to be able to go to any spot in the world, it'd be one thing to think, hey, my songs will be picked up in Detroit. But to be able to know that it's popular in Thailand, Malaysia, New Zealand,
right. That's
got to be a wonderful feeling.
It was, and it still is. I get very excited when I'm going to Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore. And, of course, we had hits in Japan. Del Shannon and I toured with Dusty Springfield.
Really?
In England. With the foreign markets, that's been very helpful to me.
Wow, that was just the Poetry in Motion little runaway tour. Wow.
Yeah, the Poetry in Motion went to number one, I believe, in England.
Wow. So jumping up 40-some years, tell me about the 2010 release, Not Enough. It was a tribute song.
Yeah, it was our way of thanking our servicemen for all the sacrifices that they make. Just saying thank you is very important to the people in the service, but it's not enough. You can say more. You can do more. It's a very patriotic song, Not Enough.
And that reached number one on the indie country chart, I see, and top 25 on another chart, breakout single on Music Row in Nashville. And that really brings me to something that stylistically, there's been, you know, between Not Enough and going back to your early hits. During the course of this interview, Johnny, we've spoken of teen idol magazines and pop charts and country pop, indie country. At the beginning of this, you did mention that you had an appreciation for country music early on, but
Oh, yeah. Still
we're looking at going all over the charts, and I'm wondering how much of this is you're trying to do something country or trying to do something pop, or if it's just music that you're making and where it ends on the charts is because of public perception.
It was public perception. I love doing country music, and I love changing the arrangements just enough so that the songs would be accepted in the pop field and the rock field and the adult contemporary field, just spreading that market out more. But the main thing we always look for was, do we have a song that sounds like, if it's recorded, that it could turn out to be a hit record. So that's why some of the songs like Heartaches by the Number and Send Me the Pillow and Dreamy Eyes, and we had markets for all those songs. So that was very helpful. Did that make any sense?
It actually did. If I took it right, you had songs and you were looking for hits, and that's what you enjoyed singing, but some of these hits could end up country or could end up pop.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to say.
Excellent.
I enjoyed this interview so much because it brought back to mind all kinds of things that have occurred to me, and I'm just so grateful for all the fans that kept my music going. So it hasn't stopped. It's still going.
Beautiful.
I think we covered some real fun stuff.
It was a lot of fun, and again, I appreciate it, and look forward to seeing you soon, John.
You got it, and thank you for everything, Dave.
Oh, you got it. Thank you. Take care now.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye.
Johnny Tillotson will be in Ontario soon, along with Leon Hughes Coasters, Sonny Turner's Platters, Little Peggy, Barbara Lewis, and Pat Boone. That's April 2nd at Gardner Spring Auditorium. More information at affordablemusicproductions.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KBC Arts. Thanks again to Johnny Tillotson. Thanks also to Dr. Joseph Annibale, author of Reclaim Your Brain. Here at KBCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Lindsay Weisgarver, Sula Ahmad, Isabella Salinas, Emmanuel Rogers, and General Manager Alfredo Cruz. Beyond the music of Johnny Tillotson heard tonight, music beds and themes heard on KBC Arts. Behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear many past KBC Arts programs via podcast at kbcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.